I'm going to start with a couple of questions that have come to me. One is a note, and one that someone brought up at the end of this morning's talk. First, the one at the end of this morning's talk. I said at the beginning of the talk that I would show how the idea of dependent arising led to or found form in the Four Noble Truths, but I don't think I actually got round to spelling that out. But I think it's quite simple, really. If we take the principle of Paticca-samuppada as simply when this is, that arises. In other words, if you create a set of conditions, a given set of conditions, that will naturally generate a particular effect. And so on and so on. It's not just a simple this and that relationship. The way I presented the Four Truths was very much within that spirit. In other words, the Four Truths organically emerge one from the other. You set up the conditions of knowing suffering, the first truth. When that is, or when this is, then the letting go of craving, grasping will happen. Letting go of grasping is there, then the stopping of grasping can happen. When the stopping of grasping is there, then the creating of a path can happen. In other words, the Four Truths are presented much as an organic sequence of conditions producing effects, conditions producing effects. It's worth perhaps emphasizing that we're not talking here about separate things. 1, 2, 3, 4. These are not separable. They're not different bits, but rather they are simply an inevitably limited way, given language, of talking about an organic process. In other words, talking about the way in which our lives can unfold. The second question on the piece of paper. There are two parts. But first of all, if I could elaborate more on my understanding of the notion of no self, I will do that, but not right now, I think. In the coming days, I'll keep coming back to that theme. And the next one is, would you explain how the Buddhist two realities, or two truths, relative and ultimate, correspond to my understanding of the teaching on transcendence? I'm glad that's come up. All of us are probably very familiar, if we've studied Buddhism in any of the schools, to think in terms of there being an ultimate or an absolute reality, paramattha-satya, on the one hand, and on the other hand, a conventional or relative reality. And the different schools of Buddhism understand this in slightly different ways. So what I think is perhaps, for me, most important to recognize is that the Buddha himself never uses these terms. They are not mentioned once in the entire Pali canon. It's a way of thinking that, to my mind, is quite alien to the Buddha's a style of teaching and style of discourse. He doesn't ever want to split the world up like that. I can accept this notion as having a certain didactic value. In other words, it's useful at times to recognize that when he says there is no self, for example, he's talking about a way of perceiving our experience in meditation, for example, in which the sense of there being a separate ego somehow is dissolved. And then when we get about in the world and we commit actions and we make choices, then clearly there is a moral agent, a self, functioning here. So to make that sort of distinction is useful. But I think it becomes quite problematic when we see it as an ontology. I promised someone I'd never use that word again. But in other words, a way of describing the nature of reality, of what is. And I think what happened in the development of British thought is it moved away from the sort of pragmatism that the Buddha emphasizes. In other words, giving us strategies and tools and not really making any claims about the nature of reality. So more concerned about the quality of our felt experience, into different kinds of philosophy that make claims as to what in fact is the ultimate nature of reality. I don't think the Buddha is actually interested in that. I don't feel that was his primary interest at all. So I find it quite comforting that the Buddha himself never felt the need to use that kind of language. And I also feel that in many ways, the doctrine of the two truths is the first kind of development of a kind of Indian Buddhism. In other words, a Buddhist discourse that's much closer, really, to the sort of distinctions we find in the Upanishads. The idea between Brahman, which would be an ultimate or an absolute truth, as opposed to Maya, which is a kind of conventional or relative truth. And my own sense is the Buddha did not use such language precisely because he sought to break free from that kind of split, that kind of dualism between a transcendent reality or unconditioned reality as opposed to a conditioned or a relative one. It's a delusion, yeah. Mm.
And this sounds to me like it's completely conditioned by others, not dependent upon conditions.
This is an issue that I actually have great difficulty with, personally. It seems to me that the whole practice of the Dharma implies that we have the freedom to choose to live otherwise. If that were not implied, frankly, I can't quite see the point of spending all this time meditating, and I could have a lot more fun than other things. But let's put it in practical terms, in terms of a given moment in meditation. You're sitting here, watching your breath, or doing whatever you do, and then an impulse arises. Let's say the beginning of a nice, juicy fantasy. Now, what do you do with that? You have, I think, the freedom within that space of attention to go with it, or not. And I feel that what that very moment is pointing to is the kind of freedom that is actually maybe more completely realized in the experiences I spoke of this morning. But that freedom not to indulge that fantasy is, I think, the ground of what then makes the experience of nirvana or liberation possible. If that were not the case, I cannot really understand how we can meaningfully speak of freedom from greed and hatred and delusion. But philosophically, yes, it's a problem. And I wonder if it's...
Very
again, free will is not exactly, it has been debated and argued for hundreds of years, free will and determinism, by people far more intelligent than me, who haven't managed to figure it out. It's still being agonized over. And it could be that it is beyond the capacity of this organism ever to somehow sort that out. Daniel Dennett recently published a book called Freedom Evolved, in which he claims to have solved the problem of how, you know, although everything is conditioned, nonetheless we can speak meaningfully of freedom. I couldn't follow his argument, it's too complicated. And recently in England I was at a conference with some colleagues discussing this exact point. We spent a whole day hammering this stuff out. And I don't think I came out any wiser, I'm afraid. So I have to admit confusion and ignorance on that point. But for all practical purposes, one idea I've had is that freedom may be an illusion, but it is a necessary and noble illusion. That's about as close as I can get to answering your question, I'm afraid. But I see the philosophical problem. But in terms of how we live our lives, I do not think we can do so without assuming freedom of that nature. Otherwise, morals, everything basically breaks down. Yes, the bathroom.
When I look back at my and still,
there's a... Well, what do you call it,
a nearness? A nearness,
a nearness. Oh, I
see.
I didn't say that, actually. We'll come back to this, and again, it's interesting, this is at the same order of difficulty as your question. Because it's clearly the case. I mean, I can remember, in fact, our first memory as a child is the point at which I become fixed. I don't remember anything before that point. That point is the beginning of the story of Stephen. In my case, it was looking out of an aeroplane window over the city of Toronto. That's where my life began as a conscious subject, and it was seems to me that ever since then, it's that same person who's been looking out at the world and he's speaking to you now. But I know that in terms of any kind of analysis, that must be false. Physically, I've totally changed. Every cell in my body has gone through numerous renewals. Emotionally, intellectually, on all levels, I'm no longer the person I was. Which is quite evidently true. I look at a photograph of myself as a 5-year-old and I don't recognize me or any doubt, let alone my mental life, which, as we sit in meditation, we can see is just a constant rush of stuff. So I think that sense we have of me is probably never going to go away. And I suspect the Buddha had it too. He had the Siddhartha sense. And I feel that probably what it is the organism's way of representing itself in a way that allows us a sense of continuity from the past into the future. I suspect it's a biological design that actually has afforded us as human beings enormous survival advantages, to have the conviction that we will persist from, say, the harvest to the next harvest. We'll be around there to reap the rewards of our labors and our friends and so on. So I think the notion of self, in that sense, is probably a product of biological evolution, and it is the way the brain pictures the organism to itself. But if we analyze the self, whether it be in meditation or whether it be through dissecting the brain or whatever it is, we will never find such a thing. It has slipped from our grasp. And the way in which Tsongkhapa and other Madhyamaka philosophers have understood the nature of emptiness is as the ultimate unfindability of that I. That doesn't mean, though, that that I does not exist. It just can never be found. We look for it, and we just keep on going forever. We'll never get to something and we'll say, ah, oh, that's who I really am. And yet, as soon as we come out of that reflection, and we're back in the world of deciding what we'll have for dinner, then your name, which I've already forgotten,
Amir,
is up and running again. So the point is not to feel that, I don't think it's the case that the Buddha literally had no sense of self, that doesn't make any sense. But that he basically did not, he was no longer tricked into thinking that that representation corresponded to some reality. It was just a function of the organism. Yes.
I want to follow up on this issue from I feel that if you stay there and examine or inquire, you're doomed to this situation. And I think that patterns and habits are the ones that help us.
I'm going to come back to some of this tomorrow. But I do think it's the case that these strategies of survival in the wild. I think the greed and hatred are likewise very. We wouldn't be here now had greed and hatred not been very effective in allowing us to survive as a species. The problem is that those deeply embedded patterns of behaviour are no longer helping us to survive, they're actually precipitating our own destruction. We were saying in English, they're long past their sell-by date. And that, I think, in all cultures, not just Buddhism, has to put into place constraints like laws, moral precepts, commandments from God, religious beliefs are in many respects strategies whereby to limit the power of such emotions and such deeply seated patterns and habits from basically just running wild. And so the Buddha, yes, I feel he is seeking to liberate us from our entrapment within the forces of our biological past. And greed, hatred and delusion, all of them, I would see really not as aspects of the mind that come from different lifetimes, but actually are deeply embedded in our neurobiology. And that's what we're working with. But I'll come back to that tomorrow, and likewise survival and existence, if I remember.
You were talking about the you said that the Buddha transcended this mind, having practices like mindfulness, generosity, etc. Like there is a quantum leap from the conditioned realm to the unconditioned.
Yeah, picking yourself up by your own feet, like yes.
It's a kind of philosophical, completely out of condition.
Well, again, I'm coming back to that tomorrow. I'm sorry to keep saying this. I regret it. Was this a good question? I think it's a very important question. And but I'll address that in my talk tomorrow morning. Yes. And only for that if it's true. It's a question.
The question is,
it didn't make sense to me. I see. I love witnesses.
The second thing is
the question. The Buddha is much more free.
The Buddha
will go
to another
set
of answers.
Not entirely. The first point you make, I accept that, yes. I think that ourself is not just something that's going on utterly within ourselves, no. It is something that is present and is in a sense a social construct as well. It's something that we, it is a shared experience, I agree. But it's also the case that when you move into the more social sense of who you are, you also can find that there is extraordinary diversity. That the person who knows you as their son, as opposed to the person who knows you as their colleague at work, as opposed to the person with whom you play golf every Saturday, are going to have very different senses, in fact, of who you are. So that, in some respects, I would say also points to the rather more multiple and plural nature of our identity. That we have the conviction that I'm like this, but different people have the conviction that we're actually very different people to those different witnesses. So that would point more, I think, to a breaking down of a sense of there being any kind of one single self, if we take that perspective into account. And in my behaviour, likewise, to my mother, as opposed to my wife, as opposed to my niece, I present myself, I go to that person, not as the same person that I would to the other. So to me that points away from a kind of singularity, rather towards a rather more multiple sense of personhood. And there are common threads, definitely. And just physically, each of those people is shown a photograph, they'll recognize it to be me. So what that person subjectively knows me as could be wildly different. And we often have examples that are rather disturbing, where somebody presents themselves in a world in a certain way, and then we find they have a secret life. That they, you know, every Thursday night they go off and do something kind of weird, and they play out another kind of personality altogether. And, you know, which is the true self? In some ways, well, I don't think you can really say. I'm reading a book at the moment about an account of a man who's had a nervous breakdown, a writer, a French writer. And one of the things that he keeps on saying is that in this state of severe depression, I'm not the person I used to be. And it's not just something that he feels, it's something that is very disturbing for his wife and his children. He's become someone else in this state of extreme nervous depression. So I think the constancy of self, which I feel is crucial, and again, I will come back to that point towards the end of the week. I don't think the Buddha is interested in trying to sort of fragment all this. I think he acknowledges the importance of cultivating a coherent and consistent identity. And I don't think no self is denying that at all, actually. The second point we'll leave open. I'll think about it. But no, you could well be right. I am an opinionated person. and I feel that that comes in some ways from the sort of ongoing, rather irrational passion I have for these ideas. And that does take me to positions, yes. I accept that. But it's part of my own struggle to make sense of my own life, and also to make sense of what this man, Siddhartha Gautama, was on about. And I don't claim to know that. I'm trying to figure it out. And this is where I am in that particular struggle at the moment. So you have to bear with it. but I hope I don't come across as too overbearingly arrogant. And if I do so, I apologize.
But it is true that he does not believe in it at the moment.
But they're like Thomas Aquinas, right? Thomas Aquinas, great, brilliant theologian. At the end of it, he wrote this incredible text, Foundation of Catholic Theology. Very end of his life, he had an experience, a mystical experience, and he said, "Everything I've written is like so many piles of straw." That might happen to me. Yes. Right. Yeah. I certainly wouldn't say that the Buddha is anti-theological. I'm taking a very selective reading of these texts, but everyone does. The beauty of the Pali Canon is the beauty of any major religious textual tradition is that it's not consistent. That it is full of conflicting voices, and therein lies its power. And clearly, just as you will find things in there that confirm your Orthodox Judaism or support it, I find things in there that support my secularism and my atheism. And that's the power of the tradition.
Okay. Straight or not straight? You have to be careful here. Again, it's not grasping doesn't mean it. This is very important. It's just you have the contact. What do you do with the contact? And I would say, in a way, to see how you do something, we do this. When we watch TV, it's very easy. We sit there and we don't do anything in certain ways. But when we watch TV, generally, we like this. We generally don't, unless we're really a pain in the back, we generally don't have a good posture. We kind of. It's not that we want the back ridges, but at the same time, we see a series of adjustments. That's what generally I say, start out tall. Because it's easier to start that way. And then you find, you kind of loosen up a little. So you loosen up a little, and then you might do this a little, and then you kind of just change it. It's kind of more like a little dance. That it's not unpopular of having it straight down, but it's just trying to keep. Because I think if we sit like this, I don't think it would be good for the back, for the stomach. And also, I don't think it would be very energetic in terms of the message. Going into the experience, how does it feel for me to try to keep it back relatively straight? In that thing that there is movement, there is not just one way. And sometimes you feel brighter, so it might be easier. And sometimes you kind of, I can see it here as a back, how sometimes I am a little straighter, and sometimes, it's a little. But both, I want it really too much like this or too much like that. I don't know, does that answer? Then there is some question over there. Yes. We'll talk about it tonight, and I will talk more about it in 2 days' time. So, if you can wait for
that. Well, certainly, theism provides a sort of very elegant solution to the problem of free will, in that, as you describe it. But it, in a sense, sets up another problem, and that is the very nature of God, and God as some kind of being who has what we call will. I find that very difficult to understand what that might mean. But let's follow the same line of thought. I think that what the Buddha is concerned about, or seems to be concerned about, is that we live our lives very often without freedom. In other words, we are propelled to act out of habit, out of attachment, out of fear, out of desire, out of jealousy, or whatever it might be. And my sense of his notion of freedom is when we come to a space within ourselves in which these forces, even though they might still be present, are not conditioning or driving us to behave according to their power. And experientially, whether it's in meditation or whether it's in a moral or a social sense, one has the feeling sometimes that one is not actually consciously choosing what one's going to say or do, but rather one finds oneself simply responding. And it's not really me anymore. And a good example of this, I find, is often when we're confronted with a great crisis or a tragedy or the suffering of a friend. And there are times when we are able so much to empathize with that person's pain that we respond from a place that we ourselves don't understand. And we find ourselves, or I find myself, saying and doing things that I'm, as it were, witness happening rather than consciously choosing to say or do. Now, theism offers us a framework for making sense of that very well. It's the will of God. The danger, I think, with that approach is that if we look at the world today, there are any number of people who believe that they are acting according to the will of God. And they threaten, I think, potentially, you know, life on earth. George Bush believes he's acting from the will of God, as does Osama bin Laden, as do, well, we don't have to name any more. And so would be my concern, or one of my concerns with that model. But yes, I do feel that the freedom we speak of is some, it's like when you do art, or when I write, I don't, when I'm really in the flow of that, I don't have the sense that I'm doing it. But I'm not, I'm reluctant to say that, therefore somebody else called God is doing it. That doesn't help me very much. I'm more interested in getting into that space and living from it. One more.
One more, but you see there are three homes. Which one do we choose?
Okay. This will be brief.
And then the two
who didn't ask the question this time will begin tomorrow. Okay? You remember who you were? Well, my team will talk about this tonight. if you don't have access to the internet here, I posted a blog on Wednesday about Moha. I'll address it. It's a bit too complicated to go into it right now. We don't have time. I think there's a lot of muddle. I think there's a lot of confusion about confusion. It's very different from avidya. Moha and avidya are not the same. In a word, I think moha is actually probably closer to what we call boredom. Avidya is it literally means not knowing, but it also means not knowing and also distorting what one knows. It's a more primary confusion about the nature of who I am, what the world is, what's going on, and at the same time distorting that into something that is actually false. Moha is a consequence of that, and moha is very much, you have raga or lobha, moha, dosa, greed, moha, and hatred. Lobha is the response, the instinctive reaction to pleasure, I want it. Hatred is the instinctive reaction to pain, I don't want it. Moha, traditionally, is the instinctive reaction to neither pleasure nor pain. In other words, I think moha is an emotion. It's not a cognitive state so much as an emotion. And how do we instinctively react to when nothing much is happening? We get bored. Moha implies a certain fogginess of mind, which is usually taken to mean stupidity or confusion. But I think emotionally, it's a state of feeling listless, restless, dull, and bored. But we'll address that later.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
and he continues his awareness with the Buddha.